Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Well, this evening we have many people gathered here, both the people who've come to stay over this weekend at Abhayagiri for the Upasika session today, and then the community work day tomorrow, and also a group from the City of 10,000 Buddhas, some of whom have been studying the Avatamsaka Sutra for the last 7 weeks, and others who are just along for the ride. Well, my knowledge of the Avatamsaka Sutra is extremely limited, but if I remember correctly, it's a very, very long sutra, hugely long. And part of the sutra is contains the story of a character called Sudana. Is that right? Yeah. Sudana. And so Sudana is this young spiritual seeker. And during the course of the story, Sudana goes from on this spiritual quest and goes. To visit one spiritual teacher after another. And in the sequence of the story, Sudana goes to visit the first teacher, and they say, well, actually, I don't really have very much accomplishment at all, but if you really want to learn something important and good, then you should go and see so-and-so. And then is referred to the next teacher. And the story goes on from one teacher to another through many different styles. Through some of the teachers are very sort of austere and holy monastics. Some are very humble workers. There's a mathematician in there. There's a prostitute. There's all kinds of different characters. This whole long huge array of different characters that Sudana goes to visit, and each one says, well, actually, I don't really have much accomplishment. If you really want to learn something important and good, you should go and see so-and-so. So that Sudana ends up visiting a whole array of different teachers, but not because he is restless or unsatisfied with each teaching, but the teachers are saying, you know, you should try the next one down the line. So, for most of us, it works in a slightly different way, sort of the opposite of Sudana's quest, or sort of Dudana, whereby it's because we go to visit one teacher, or we follow one kind of practice, we're in one kind of place, and we think, well, this isn't really working, this is no good, I'll see what's over there. And say, well, this isn't really good. This isn't really working. I'll see what's over there, and over there, and over there. And so it's not the advice coming from outside that's telling us to move on and learn from something else, somewhere else. But it's our own restlessness, our own impatience, our own kind of discontent that's driving things along. Is that familiar? I think this goes across Buddhist traditions, whether you're from the southern tradition or the northern tradition or the eastern or western or whichever planet you're from. This same pattern tends to pertain. This is the way we tend to be. Always looking for the other. So if you're say before coming to a monastery, or if you're living as a lay Buddhist, a lay person, then we tend to be going from one kind of practice to another. Firstly, you're into concentration practice, and then you're into insight practice, and then you get into Advaita Vedanta, and then off to Sufi dancing, and then that gets a bit too exhausting. So then back to walking in slow motion, and that gets a bit frustrating. So you go to the beach for a few months, and then you want to tighten up a bit, so then you realize you get to the come to the conclusion that hatha yoga is the way, so you spend a lot of time developing hatha yoga, and then that's a bit too muscular, so then you get into qigong and you learn to move your qi around, and then one thing after another, and it's like, well, this isn't quite it, what about that, and what about that, and what about that? So similarly, even if you're in the monastery, living, you've already made some kind of a commitment, living in the monastery, then it can be that we develop discontent in our lives, and we're not just never quite settled with the meditation practice that we have. We're always this isn't working. I need to do something to help me concentrate better. I better eat. Eat less. I'm eating far too much. I need to cut down on my diet. I need to just eat the raw vegetable, just a salad and a fruit. That's what I need. I need to be a fruit monk. I should be a fruit monk. Just eat the fruit and the raw stuff. Or I'm being too uptight. I'm getting too faddish about my eating habits. I should just eat anything I want to and not make a fuss about it. That's what I need to do. I'm getting too uptight about the eating thing. All right. I need to sleep less. I'm overindulgent in sleep. I should sleep less. So I should not lie down to sleep. That's it. And I think, well, I'm exhausted. I really need to have more sleep so I can concentrate better. Because, I'm getting too tired, so I can't concentrate properly in the meditation. I need to do more walking practice. I need to do less walking practice. I need to study some more. I don't really understand the Dhamma. I've been this for years. And I don't really have I can't even name all eight of the Eightfold Path. And I've been here for 10 years, and I can only get six or seven of them. I really should be doing better than this. I should study. I'm not getting down to it. I can't even, do the morning and evening chanting, let alone recite the Dhammacakka Sutra and the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. And then the other day when we did the funeral chanting, I was completely lost. People haven't been dying recently, so I kind of got out of practice, and I need to really get down to it, study the chanting and learn all of that. I'm just not paying enough attention to my, to the study and the devotional practices. So we can have that same kind of restlessness within the monastery and the field that we're in, and just in the terms of where we place the emphasis of our practice. Or it can be some friends of ours called the other monastery syndrome. It's like in the other monastery where they get it right. In the other monastery, they're really strict vegetarians. Or in the other monastery, the monks and the nuns are totally equal. In the other monastery, they have a really enlightened teacher. In the other monastery, everyone follows the discipline absolutely perfectly. In the other monastery, everyone's really relaxed. In the other monastery, depending on what your particular fantasy of the moment is, there's the other monastery where that is embodied. In the other monastery, they don't muck around. They don't have this kind of nonsense about breakfast. Pah! This is kind of one meal a day, death or glory. In the other monastery, they never lie down at night. It's not even an option. Or in the other monastery, they break out the sake and everyone gets drunk one day of the year. They're not uptight like us lot, They kind of know how to let go of the rules at the right time. In the other monastery. So that's what the mind does, isn't it? He says, if I was at Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, if I was at Harada Roshi's monastery, if I was at the City of 10,000 Buddhas, if I was at Abhayagiri, I am at Abhayagiri. No. it's the other place where everything is right, everything is better. And it's different. It's not unsatisfactory or insufficient or not quite right like this place, the way it is here now. Now this is like an itch, he said, scratching his neck. It's the human itch that is common to birth. This is what got us born in the first place. is this itch of not being in quite the right place. So we get born again. Right? This is what drives the wheel of birth and death, is this itch of, this isn't quite right, what about over there? What about, if I just had a bit more of this, if I just had a bit less of that, if it was just a bit more serious, if it was just a bit more casual, if it was a bit more strict, if it was a bit more gentle, if there was a bit more variety, if it was a bit more simple, if there was more people, if there's less people, if it was hotter, if it was colder, and on and on and on and on and on. This is rebirth. This is the urge to become something other. That this is never quite it. And that something, there's a promise of something other which is going to be it, which is going to provide it, which is going to be the thing that makes all the difference. So the Buddha's teaching is, if we actually listen to it rather than just take it at a superficial level, if we listen to it and apply it, then it'll point our attention right to that very itch. It will point to, what is that? Why is this never quite enough? Why is that always promising a little bit better? A little bit more, a little bit righter? But we very rarely actually listen to the Buddha's teaching and apply it. You know, we grab the externals. We take hold of the external form and we think, well, if only there was, you know, more of this form, you know, longer meditation periods, or if I had better concentration, if I could just stay with my breath a lot longer, if I could just hold the mantra, if I could just remember the sutra, if I learned to recite the whole of the Avatamsaka Sutra, this great big thick book, 40 rolls of Chinese script, I believe, that would be awesome, truly awesome. I'm sure if I could do that, then enlightenment would only be inches away, if not already accomplished. So we attach to the externals. We think, if I learn this mantra, if I fix my mind and absorb into jhana, if I have the insight into anatta, if I'm just in the presence of the great teacher, if only I had been alive when Ajahn Mun was teaching. Well, maybe you were. Maybe you were the one at the back who was having opinions about what the Ajahn was saying while he was talking. So if only I was there when the Buddha was teaching. Well, we probably were. But we were the ones who were dozing at the back. Or arguing with what the Buddha was saying as he was saying it. So this is what the mind does, you know, and this is certainly a habit that I have had, and that we take hold of the externals, and we think that the externals, taking hold of the form, even noble and wholesome forms, we think, if I just adopt this form, if I just surrender to the form, if I just am a really good monk, if I just do everything right, then I will be purified, then everything will be good. If I'm just really sincere and I really, you know, follow the rules strictly, or I follow the practice to the limit, then that will be the right thing, because the Buddha said you should do this. You know, you should keep the precepts. You should develop meditation. You should learn how to concentrate. You should develop insight. So, and it seems like we're doing all the right things. We're following the formula. The Buddha said do this. Okay, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I'm doing it. And yet, the painful reality is so often that we're very sincerely grabbing hold of the externals and missing the essence, missing the truth of it. We're trying to do everything properly, everything right, but we don't realize that we're just taking hold of the appearances, the forms, the structures, and we're missing the essence of it. Ajahn Chah would say, this is like someone gives you a banana and you carefully, mindfully peel the banana, then you eat the skin and throw the banana away. Right? But we take hold of the externals and the structures and miss the essence. Earlier today, when the group from the City of 10,000 Buddhas arrived, they were asking me about, they'd heard some story about the Venerable Master Hua appearing in a dream of mine, and so I was recollecting that. And it was actually on this theme, which is, I guess, why I'm talking about it this evening, was this kind of theme, because when Ajahn Sumedho first came back, first met Master Hua in 1981, and he came back to England, and he had a number of Dhamma books that had been published by the what was then called the Sino-American Buddhist Association, the Buddhist Text Translation Society. And so these books had a big impact in our community. And I remember reading the Sixth Patriarch Sutra and the Dharani Sutra and many of these texts, are both the translated sutras and then the master's commentaries on them. And so many of us got very enthusiastic about these teachings and these practices. And it was very definitely that the Gold Mountain Monastery and City of 10,000 Buddhas was definitely the other monastery. It was the other monastery where, you know, these guys, they never lie down. Unless you're younger than 10 or you're older than 70, no one lies down, ever. Not even when they die. You know, even if you were dead and they tried to lay your body down, I'm sure they'd sit up. So, Sixth Patriarch, you know, he died 1,300 years ago and he's still sitting. He hasn't even decayed. Great Master Hui Neng is still sitting there in his glass case, not waiting for the bell. You can see I got a photograph of him. I kept a photograph of Great Master Hui Neng sitting, body didn't decay, 1,300 years old, sitting. After he died, his body never degenerated, so I thought. So became very inspired, myself and several others, and we would learn various of the teachings and the mantras, learned to recite the Great Compassion Mantra, and so and developed a lot of faith in Master Hua's teachings and the level of practice, the style of practice at City of 10,000 Buddhas. And so then, but over time, even though the intention was to be very sincere, then, and so I took on many of these practices, so I wasn't lying down at night for about 3 years, from I think 1984 to 87. I was just sleeping, sitting up, and sleeping, well, I was walking around most of the time as well. was super strict with avoiding all the non-vegetarian foods and onions and garlic and all these kind of carefully picking onions out of my bowl, which is not easy when people are sort of spooning oniony soup and great lumps of pizza into your bowl, and you have to carefully, strand by strand, out comes the onion and the leek, the leaves of the leeks and everything. I have these little piles in the corner of my bowl where all of the pungent section was being carefully weeded out, and because I was trying to be so sincere and follow these, the guidelines that were there in these teachings. And so I carried on in this way for quite some time, about 3 or 4 years, and all the time feeling like I was trying to be more sincere, trying to be more energetic, trying to be more pure, and not really noticing that I was just sort of accumulating this whole huge program of stuff. And finally, towards the end of 1987, I began to feel like I was carrying this enormous weight around. Like this sort of, like, if you know when you're traveling and you've got too much luggage and you've got sort of suitcases under each arm and kind of things over your shoulders, and just sort of, it's incredibly cumbersome, difficult. And so after some time, I began to feel like, why, and I'm doing all these things to liberate myself. Why is life so clogged up? Why do I feel so burdened? I'm trying so hard to be liberated and to free the heart with all these good things. How come it feels like I'm carrying 7.5 suitcases, struggling down the platform, racing, trying to keep up with a moving train? And then one day, I'm not sure if it was right at that time. I think it was around that time. But I had this dream. In this dream, it was very, very clear. It was quite brief. But in this dream, Master Hua very clearly appeared. So it was very clear image of his face. And he looked at me and he said, "Do you want my toenails?" That was it. That was the entire teaching. Do you want my toenails? Now, a little bit of background to this. It was extremely vivid, and I kind of had this dream was there, and I woke up and I thought, what? And then, you know, Shurfu had this kind of face that can have four or five or six expressions all at the same time. You know, sort of different things are happening in different regions of his face at any one moment. And so there was this very clear image of his face that was both sort of quizzical, like he was definitely asking a question, and it was compassionate, and also having a good laugh, and also pointing the finger at the same time. All of those, and a few, you know, a couple of others as well, probably. So I thought, do you want my toenails? And then I was pondering that, and then immediately I remembered a story that Ajahn Sumedho had told about when he was visiting a great master called Lumpu Khao, who actually some of his relics are here in this little reliquary. So Lumpu Khao was a disciple of Lumpu Man, Ajahn Man, who was Ajahn Chah's teacher. So Lumpu Khao was an elder monk who was a disciple of Ajahn Man. And many years before, Ajahn Chah, our teacher, had taken Ajahn Sumedho off on a tour to visit some of the great teachers, the other disciples of Ajahn Man who were still alive, like Ajahn Phan, Ajahn Mahabua, Lumpu Khao, Lumpu Thet. So they went on this sort of Dharma journey through the northeast of Thailand, visiting some of these great elders. And actually, Ajahn Chah he'd been given a tape recorder, which in northeast Thailand in those days was a very rare and strange thing. But Ajahn Chah had this inspiration to tape and record some of the teachings of these great elders before they died and passed away. And now, he was always a kind of creative character. He was always looking for different ways of expressing things, and he was very imaginative. And so, when this tape recorder came along, he thought, well, this would be great. We can sort of capture the teachings of some of the great Ajahns before they fade away and before they're lost to the world. So anyway, he took Ajahn Sumedho on this trip up to the northeast, and they went to see Lumpu Khao. And on this particular occasion, they were gathered there in his monastery, and then a group of lay people, many groups of lay people, came. And so Lumpur was giving some teachings and gave a very fine Dhamma talk to the people. And then it was asked them if they had any questions, and so they talked for a while, and they had a very nice sort of Dhamma conversation, and then with the monks that were there as part of the group, and and it felt to Ajahn Sumedho like it was a very nice Dhamma exchange, and that it seemed to be quite sort of energetic, and people were really interested. During that time, Lumpu Khao had been clipping his fingernails and his toenails. It's kind of ordinary thing to do in northeast Thailand. Sort of personal grooming can easily happen just public areas. Ajahn Chah was known to sit up on the Dhamma seat and clip his toenails, you know, clip his fingernails, just sort of waiting for the inspiration to come for a Dhamma talk to begin. Seriously, he would just sit there just waiting for a theme to arrive. And then also during the time that he'd been talking, Lumpu Khao had been chewing betel nut. So he'd been spitting his betel nut into this spittoon and dropping the bits of nail clippings in there as well. And so after this long session with talking with these people, then at the end of the time, then the people were about to take their leave, and they said, "Oh, you know, Lumpur, can we have, you know, your spittoon?" And they were kind of nervous about asking for this, and Lumpur says, "Why do you want that?" He says, "Well, it's just, you know, it's a lot of merit, you know, a lot of good fortune that comes from these things. It's just my betel nut. It's just fingernails, toenails, you know, it's just rubbish." And they said, "Oh, but Lumpur, you know, it'd be really a great favor for us, you know, please." And then, so he gave them a bit of a bad time, and eventually just let them take it, so they could gather together all of this kind of gunk and take it away as sort of treasured relics. And then he said after they'd gone, he turned to Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah and said, "Isn't it amazing? You know, you offer them the Dharma. You know, people come and you offer them the Dharma, and all they want is your excrement." And so, and then Ajahn Sumedho realized that even though it had seemed that though people were pretty interested, he kind of, on retrospect, he thought, well, actually, maybe the people weren't really paying attention at all to what all the fine teachings that Lumpu Kha had been giving, but actually they were just sort of waiting to get the get the magic charms, you know, the fingernails and the chewed betel nut and his toenail clippings. Yeah, it was the really serious stuff. That was the those were the real goodies. So that was the comment. You know, you offer them the Dhamma, and all they want is your excrement. So this image of Master Hua appearing in this dream, saying, "Do you want my toenails?" It brought back this story, because Ajahn Sumedho had told that story many, many times about Lumpu Khao's comment. And I realized, you know, I hadn't been thinking of it in those terms, but you know, this is what I've been doing. I've just been collecting all of this kind of superficial stuff, all of the toenails and the clippings and the external trappings of all these Dhamma. But it's just the excretions, really, the words and the forms and the practices that you know they have a lot of respect that they carried within our traditions. But you know, what I'm doing is just like the people collecting the chewed betel nut and the toenail clippings. I'm just collecting all this stuff, these mantras and these practices and you know, all the other duties that I had at the monastery, you know, the kind of work that I was doing, and so many things that what I related to as good practice. It was just, you know, more is better. More asceticism, more austere practices, more strictness, more everything. More of these good things that I accumulate and I am and I carry these around, then that means I'm a better monk, right? But then what was so clear then was this just an almost feeling of burdenness. There's this me carrying around all this stuff, and that it was just this mental image of this carrying around these sort of sacks full of toenail clippings. All of this, the kind of Dharma accoutrements, Dharma hardware, and missing the reality of it, missing the essence. Or like, you know, the image that Ajahn Chah gave, you know, carefully peeling the banana, then eating the peel and throwing away the fruit and wondering why it tastes bad and I've got indigestion. So this is the challenge for us, is to see, you know, where are we missing it? Where are we just attaching to the forms? And our own sincerity is being sidetracked by clinging to the conventions, clinging to the rites and rituals, clinging to the ideas and the forms that what are we believing in? That this is going to purify me or liberate me if I just do this thing, if I just repeat these words, if I carry out this movement, if I engage in this way. This in itself is going to free me. But the Buddha, if we look at the Buddha's teachings and take those to heart, we see over and over again that this was the problem with the Brahmins and the yogis of his time. They thought, if that was their belief, if we just bathe in the Ganga, if we just recite these mantras, then we will be purified, then we will go to heaven, then we will be free, then we will reunite with Brahman, etc. And the Buddha said, no, it's not a fixed thing. These might be skillful, or they might be innocent in their own way, but they cannot liberate in and of themselves. Just reciting a particular syllable, making a movement with the body, performing a particular action, saying a particular word, these cannot have intrinsic ultimate value. It's a sound. It's a movement. It's a texture. It's a feeling. It's part of the five khandhas that are empty, impermanent, not self. So this is what in the southern tradition, in the Pali, is called silapata paramasa, or attachment to conventions, attachment to rites and rituals or observances. And this is seen as one of the obstructions to the initial obstructions to enlightenment, and that if we can't see through this quality, the silapata paramasa, then we can't even enter the stream of Dhamma. So this is one of the first three of the obstructions to enlightenment. So it's really crucial that we understand this kind of delusion that affects us so strongly. Because if we don't, then we never see the source of the itch. We always think that it's just by changing the convention, changing the practice, changing the place, changing the religion, changing the venue, changing the teacher, changing our meditation cushion is going to make the difference. You know, that we somehow believe that the form or the action is it, but you are it. This is the crucial piece. It's like you are it. That our own heart is it. This is where the Dhamma lies. It's in our very own nature. That's why, like so many times, there's the language of, you know, of turning the light around. It's like no longer looking outwards into the particular forms of concentration, the particular kinds of expressions of wisdom, the particular practices, the locations or particular teachers. It's turning that around, turning the attention inwards and realizing the Dhamma of our own nature here and now. That's like seeing that it's that quality of completion and fulfillment is not somewhere else. It's here within our own nature, within our own heart. It's the very substance, the very fabric of our own heart, the nature of the jitta, the nature of our own heart is, you can say, is Buddha, is awakened awareness, is Dhamma, is the fundamental reality. That this is the basic nature of our own heart, our own mind. So that all of the practices that we do, the different opportunities we have, the sutras that we study, the effort that we make, this has been a kind of community work weekend, painting and we were doing a lot of oiling, got very up close and personal with a lot of pine paneling today. Watco oil and pine paneling, you know. Whatever form our Dhamma practice is taking, whether it's rubbing Watco oil into pine paneling or studying the Avatamsaka Sutra or finding out how to nail hardy panel without breaking the corners off, driving up and down the hill to get, you know, more materials and tools, and or just sitting in the office and answering all the phone calls, sitting here in the Dhamma hall listening to a desana. Whatever forms and structures our practice takes, yeah, those different elements, those different forms, whether they are, we would formally call it studying the Dhamma or practicing the Dhamma, like meditation or reading a sutta, etc., reciting a sutta, or whether it's something informal, just, you know, the getting up and walking out of the hall, seeing the stars in the night sky, you know, walking to the bathroom, whatever it might be, that to see that what the structure of this of these teachings and these forms, they're all there to help turn the attention back to realize the Dhamma that is our own nature, as it's described in the chanting, apparent here and now, timeless, sanditiko akaliko, ehi pasiko, inviting one to come and see, opanaiko, leading inwards. Pachatang veditabo vinyuhi, to be realized by each wise person for themselves. So this is the task that we have, is to not to be looking for the external forms or to be relying on the external forms, but always to be taking those forms and structures not as an end in themselves. So as I keep saying people to people here, you know, we're not building kutis, cabins in the forest, to build cabins. We're building cabins in order to liberate the heart. You know, building the monastery is what makes the monastery is the liberated heart. It's not this beautiful forest or these, you know, lovely hills or the fine humans that live here and or come and visit. But the building of what's the very fabric of the monastery is the nature of this heart. So it's always a challenge to be remembering to use the meditations and the teachings and the forms to reflect back to that, to be internalized in that way, so that we remember it's not just learning the words, it's not just sitting up straight, it's not just focusing the attention on this object. It's how that can help to liberate the heart. So also just to finish with, go back to the occasion of Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho visiting Lumpu Khao. Ajahn Chah, he was known as one who was, he was very cautious or didn't talk a lot about psychic powers, past life experiences. He played that right down, because in Thailand, like most Buddhist countries, people love stories about, you know, miracles, right? Is that the case in the Chinese tradition? People love miracles, amazing things, and love to know about, you know, nuns and monks with psychic powers who can read people's minds and see into the past and the future and all those things. And Ajahn Chah, he could see that people get really excited about all of that. I mean, talk about external stuff. People get really excited about all of that psychic activity. So he tended to play it down and not make much of it at all. And so when people would ask him about it, he would just change the subject or say, "Why do you want to know? Why do you want to know who you were in the past when you don't even know who you are now?" So he was pretty good at these deflating remarks. But one time that he was, he actually was moved to rejoice in what he said, what he regarded as great psychic feat, was when they were recording. This is the story as Ajahn Sumedho told it. When they had the tape recorder set up, and so they asked Lumpu Khao to give a Dhamma talk. And so they set it all up, and they contested the microphone, and everything was working. They set the, and this was in the those of you who are now MP3 iPod users will probably not even have heard of this, but there used to be tape recorders used to actually have tapes running from reel to reel. It was like an old reel to reel tape recorder. Remember those, us gray haired ones? Reel to reel, little reel to reel tape recorder. So they had it all set up and the microphone, Ajahn Sumedho tested the microphone, it was all working. So then Lumpu Khao started giving this Dhamma talk and was giving these teachings, and it got very long and sort of extensive Dhamma Desana. And some distance into the Dhamma talk, he leaned over to one side and farted very loudly. And then he just carried on with his Dhamma talk. And so when they paid their respects some hours later, and they'd gone off and they were back in their kutis, and Ajahn Sumedho, Lumpur Cha said, "Well, let's listen to that tape of Lumpur again. You know, I want to hear, you know, Lumpur's Dhamma talk again." And they turned the tape on, and it was completely silent, except for the fart. It was just completely silent. And then Lumpur said, "Now that's psychic powers." So even Ajahn Chah could see that he was attached to the words of the Dhamma, and it was how that actually happened. I don't pretend to know, but Lumpur could see that even he was trying to capture the words and to keep the words, and that somehow or other things had arranged themselves that, you know, the words were not going to get caught, and that there were the message, but the message remained on the tape. So Lumpur Cha kind of took that as his teaching and said, "Okay, no more taping." So he gave up on the recording of the Kruba Ajahn's after that. He just was trusted his own inner tape recorder after that time. So I offer these words for consideration this evening. Please take whatever is useful.